Welcome, everybody, to Crystal, Kyle, and Friends. As you can see, today it is just Crystal, no Kyle. But we do, in fact, have a fantastic friend for you today. Very lucky to be joined by Moeen Rabbani. Probably a lot of you saw him in that big debate on the Lex Fridman podcast. He is a senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies. He's a co-editor of a magazine called Jadalia, contributing editor to the Middle East Report. And most importantly, he is just an astonishing expert and humanitarian on the Israel-Palestine crisis. I think he's been one of the most important voices throughout this conflict, but especially post-October 7th. Those of you who did watch that debate, I'm sure, came away with that same sense. So we are very lucky to talk to Moeen today. Let's get to it. Moeen Rabbani, welcome. So great to have you.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Crystal. It's good to be with you again.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I just mentioned, I think a lot of people came to be familiar with you and your work based on this big Lex Fridman debate. 5 hours long, if anyone wants to check it out. I don't want to dwell on it. There are many more important things to get to, but just wondering if you have any sort of reflections after the fact on the usefulness of it and experience of going through it.
Not particularly. I don't really think it's appropriate for me to tell people what they should think about it. If anyone wants to endure 5 hours of viewing and listening, then I would leave it to them to make up their own minds about the issues discussed and how they were presented. I would just hope that many people who were previously unfamiliar with or perhaps uninterested in these issues will now be more familiar and interested in them, because these are, after all, life and death matters for many, 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 too many people.
How much historical specific knowledge do you think that one needs to have in order to confidently have an opinion about what is being done by Israel right now?
I think it's a bit of a complex question. Of course, opinions are a dime a dozen, but I think opinions also needed to be rooted in reality. And I think if you're looking at what Israel is doing now, on the one hand, it doesn't require much historical knowledge to know that murdering tens of thousands of civilians, including thousands upon thousands upon thousands of children, particularly, of creating a famine for the purpose of creating a famine and starving a people into submission, I don't think that really requires any specialized knowledge to form an opinion. I mean, it's kind of, you know, seeing a murder or a robbery transpire before your eyes. You don't really need to know much about criminal law to understand right from wrong. But I think in terms of the broader questions of how did we come to this point, why did this happen, what are its potential consequences, there I do think a basic level of familiarity with the relevant history and the relevant reality is useful, if not necessary.
Yeah, I think that's all correct. I wonder if you could just briefly share with people how you came to be a scholar and a student of this conflict and to have accumulated the incredible depth and specificity of knowledge that you bring to the table.
Well, I wouldn't consider myself a scholar as such. I'm not an academic. I didn't complete my doctorate, unfortunately, but I'm Palestinian. I grew up in a Palestinian household. Both my parents, who were made refugees during 1948 by the Nakba, were their entire lives deeply, deeply and passionately invested in this issue. It's something to which I had a bit of resentment, I have to say, as a child, because to me, Palestine, in a way, when I was first growing up, represented, why my parents always had people over or come visit other people instead of spending even more time with their children, although they're fantastic parents and always have been. That's not the issue. But, when I became a teenager and began to be more interested and started reading and started studying and started listening, I would say it's basically, knowledge accumulated over several decades of reading others, of listening to others, of doing my own research. I lived in the region for more than 20 years. I think maybe, maybe I first began to develop an interest in it. I grew up in the Netherlands and went to an American school. And at the time of the Iranian Revolution, you know, most of my classmates were Americans. And at the time of the Iranian hostage crisis, you know, when Iranian radicals took took over the U.S. embassy and held its staff hostage for over a year, my classmates started asking me, "So, are you Sunni or Shiite?" And I had absolutely no clue. You know, we weren't we weren't raised that way, so I had to go home and ask my mom, "Are we Sunni or Shiite?" You know, so, and that in a way triggered also my broader interest in not only Palestine, but the region and its history.
So once you started pulling that thread, it just kept following it over a lifetime, basically.
Well, I think that's a good way to put it. And, you know, after all, these are my people. These are my rights. You know, this is my past and my future. So there's definitely also a very personal element. But most importantly, I would say, it's the cause of an entire people, not of an individual or of a family. And the rights of this people and the future of this people, as we're seeing, you know, so dramatically and so catastrophically now in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, I that is certainly the case. I would say it is also the cause of humanity more broadly, though. I actually saw a good op-ed in Haaretz talking about how when you see this level of death and annihilation, it cheapens all of human life. Because, yes, you know, it makes other also, you know, horrors and atrocities seem less in comparison. So for everyone, every human being around the world, watching this level of consistent daily death, destruction, starvation, et cetera, it really does cheapen the value of human life for literally everyone.
Well, I think that's very well put, and you described it, I think, quite rightly as a cause for humanity. But I also have to say that's a fairly recent development. As I mentioned, I grew up in Europe, in Western Europe. You could say under the long shadow of the Second World War, that was still a very live issue in Dutch society when I was a child. And I think it's fair to say that during that period, Israel was considered the cause of humanity, at least in the West. And people were almost willfully blind to Israel's treatment and policies towards the Palestinian people, because particularly at the popular level, people tended to equate Israel with the Holocaust. You know, the Holocaust was horrific, therefore Israel is tremendous. And it really took decades, and I would say of very hard work by Palestinians around the world, by people like my parents who lived in Europe, to begin to help people understand that there's a fundamental difference between Jewish history in Europe and Israel's policies towards the Palestinians in the Middle East, that these are essentially two separate phenomena that each need to be judged and assessed on their own merits, rather as being seen in some way as one being justified by the other. You know, the old saying, two wrongs don't make a right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very much becoming kind of the majority view now, not only, I would say, in the world, in the broader international community, where it's kind of always been that way, but even more profoundly now in the West, which has been the basis of popular and also, of course, governmental support for Israel and its policies towards the Palestinian people.
To what do you attribute the fact that young Americans in particular seem to have a dramatically different view of this conflict than older Americans? Even if you look within the Democratic Party, the polling is quite stark between the oldest cohorts and the youngest ones.
Yeah. I think there's several factors. First of all, I think, you know, that this generation grew up with very different points of historical reference, of political reference, if you will, than their parents, their grandparents. So for example, my neighbors, where I grew up in the Netherlands, grew up, you know, they remember the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands, the hunger winter, the deportation and extermination of their Jewish neighbors and all the rest of it, and tended to see the Middle East as kind of an appendage of what had happened in their own countries within their lifetime. Secondly, they, as part of this also, you know, the Cold War succeeded the Second World War. For many people, the United States was seen as the guarantor of their welfare and security after the Second World War. So there tended to be a very strong Atlanticist element to their views of the world. So they also tended to follow Washington's lead in international affairs. You look at the current generation, well, their experiences are fundamentally different. Many of them were born after the Cold War. Their experience of American Middle East policy is, for example, the illegal invasion and occupation and destruction of Iraq by the United States in 2003. They have much better access to information than previous generations did. You know, when I was growing up, we had two terrestrial television channels that had news bulletins, if I remember correctly, at 6, 8, and 10 p.m. And that was it. And if you wanted more frequent news, you had to tune in on shortwave to BBC World Service. I don't need to explain what the media landscape looks like now. But you know, as many people have noted, no genocide has ever been broadcast live in real time, the way we're seeing now in the Gaza Strip. I mean, even Bosnia or Rwanda or Myanmar weren't this accessible. And I think another aspect is that Israel's policy is very much in your face. I mean, they really used to take care of winning over the uncommitted, of trying to influence public opinion, of posing as the victim of their victims, and so on. Now, you know, as Bush said in 2003, you're either with us or with the terrorists. Well, they're the same way. You know, you're either fully on board with us and our extreme agenda, or you're an enemy and we'll treat you as such. And it's much more difficult for them also, I think, to control information. You know, a few decades ago, Israel was seen as kind of this liberal, even socialist beacon in the Middle East, and as kind of a standard bearer of values that the West proclaims for itself. Well, it's become much more difficult to sustain that when news is not limited to three short bulletins a day provided by a public broadcaster. So I think, again, I think younger generations have different experiences, have different perspectives, have much better options to make up their own minds because they have much greater access to information than we did.
Yeah, which has precipitated a whole unhinged freak out about the platforms that they're getting some of that information from, in particular, yes. TikTok.
Yeah.
And has really... And you know what? They don't even deny that those two things are connected. There are multiple, you know, people on the record saying, yeah, this is part of why we need to ban TikTok, because you've got all of this Free Palestine energy unfolding on the platform. And they can't imagine that, you know, the problem is what people are actually seeing unfold versus the particular social media platforms on which they are seeing that accurate information.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, on the one hand, these are the same people who are claiming to teach democracy and freedom of the press and freedom of expression and all the rest of it to all us underdeveloped savages in the rest of the world. But at the same time, as you said, are explicitly identifying freedom of expression as a threat, freedom of information as a threat, and are using the availability of unmediated and uncensored information about Palestine and Israeli policy towards the Palestinians as a reason to suppress this one forum. You know, they may well succeed, but it's really a question of winning a battle but losing the war, because TikTok is just one of many forums that are being used to help people access facts and reality about what is actually happening in the region.
Yeah, and that is really absolutely vital. There was some polling that just came out from Pew Research that showed, first of all, and this is just, you know, I think a complete example of media failure, only half of Americans could even answer the question of whether Israelis or Palestinians had lost more lives since October 7th, including October 7th. So half of Americans just, I don't know. And then if you poll those people who say they don't know, their view of the conflict, very different from people who have the accurate understanding that Palestinians, of course, have a multiples times higher death rate during this, you know, post-October 7th. And that has made them much more pro-Palestinian, made them much more critical of Joe Biden and his policy of unconditional support and of the bear hug of Netanyahu that we've seen since this has all unfolded.
Yeah, I have to say I'm not really surprised, because particularly if you're talking about older generations, others who still get their primary information from legacy media, from mainstream media. Well, you know, October 7th, the Palestinian attacks on southern Israel happened. That was kind of dominated news coverage for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks afterwards, even as Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip very quickly began to take on genocidal proportions. That Israeli war on the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip was very, and mainstream coverage was very much subordinated to the continuing primacy given to the attacks of October 7th. You saw detailed stories about individual victims, individual survivors of those attacks, individuals who somehow had a relationship to those attacks. We've seen virtually none of that and coverage of the Palestinians, who just tend to be these anonymous, swarthy numbers who are, in a sense, you know, getting what they had coming to them. And you've seen kind of these, you know, Israeli and U.S. official stories, whether about the first attack on a Palestinian hospital, the Ahli Baptist Hospital in Gaza City, or then the, you know, purported command center under Al-Shifa Hospital, or then the big expose in the New York Times, which I'd like to call screams without evidence rather than screams without words, about supposedly mass organized systematic rape, which is now being gradually withdrawn by that paper. I mean, it's very reminiscent of the weapons of mass destruction story that was kind of peddled by these very same media in the run up to the 2003 Iraq War.
And Maureen, what is your assessment of what leads to that type of coverage? I mean, with Screams Without Words, this New York Times piece, which is now, I mean, it immediately came into question because the family members of one of the primary subjects who the story was built around immediately came out and said, "We, first of all, we didn't know you were interviewing us in connection with asserting that our lost loved one had been raped. Second of all," a number of them said, "we don't believe this is true. In fact, we have evidence to the contrary that says this isn't true." And since then, we've learned about the authors, one of whom had no journalistic experience, certainly not the level of experience that you would expect to undertake such a critical and sensitive project, who had previously served in the IDF. We've come to learn now, actually, the New York Times themselves reporting that a key portion of their own story had been recanted and by video evidence had disputed the findings of that story. So what is it that leads to this type of, I mean, you can't just call it shoddy reporting. This is just out and out propaganda, doing the bid of exactly what the Israelis, the message they wanted to put out to the world was at that moment.
And I would like to start by just recognizing the efforts of two individuals, Arun Gupta, who wrote a major expose of the story in Yes Magazine and also contributed substantial reporting to The Intercept's coverage of this issue, and Leila Larian of Al Jazeera, who has been on this story from the very outset and has followed it with the eyes of a hawk. People call the New York Times American Pravda for a reason. It tends to be an outlet for official opinion. It wasn't, I think 2003 is and the buildup to the Iraq War is a very good example of this. It's not that Judith Miller went haywire and started publishing stories that later turned out to be false. She had supervisors, she had editors, she had proofreaders, she had fact checkers. So the whole apparatus was mobilized and dedicated to supporting and promoting the official party line on Iraq and its supposed possession of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. And here the story is no different. It's not only Israeli propaganda that's being promoted in these media. It's important to recognize that it's also American propaganda. And if this was a case where Israel was putting out all these fabrications, but the U.S. government wasn't adopting them and promoting them itself, I think we would probably see significantly less coverage given to these fabrications and less credibility allotted to them. But since you have the head of state, President Joe Biden, repeatedly stating that he saw images of beheaded babies, where these images simply don't exist, where you have senior U.S. officials talking about babies being roasted in ovens and hung from clotheslines and all the rest of it, all of which is, pure imagination and fabrication. Well, when you have, on the one hand, your own government coming out so strongly in support of fabrications being put out by one of its favored client regimes and effectively making Israel's narrative its own, well, that creates, I think, the kind of environment where these types of media, as they have always done, can be expected to promote these stories and these perspectives, because it's these aren't just stories being reported; these are stories being reported with a political agenda to support specific policies. What Noam Chomsky called manufacturing consent, and that's precisely what's happening here.
I saw someone on Twitter note that it is remarkable, it's a remarkable coincidence or non-coincidence, that the three big failures in recent memory with the New York Times, the Iraq WMD, the Caliphate podcast, and now Screams Without Words, all have to do with Middle East policy.
Yeah. And the person who made that observation, in fact, is Leila Larian,
Yeah. What do you make of Joe Biden and his posture? I want to ask you specifically about the UN ceasefire resolution, but just in general, you were talking about how older generations have this different historical reference point. He seems to me to be very ideologically locked into his position to the extreme that he is actually willing to risk his own reelection in order to be there to help facilitate this genocide.
I fully agree with you. I think for Joe Biden, Israel is a matter of principle. It's a matter of ideological commitment. It's not a principle that he's prepared to sacrifice for his own political interest. My sense, and I may disagree with others here, is that he is well aware of the political price he is paying and may end up paying in November for his steadfast support and solidarity with Israel and its genocide. And I think from his perspective, it's a price worth paying because this is something he genuinely and passionately believes in. Biden is a self-proclaimed proud Zionist. Biden developed his political career during the Cold War when the general consensus among U.S. political elites was that Israel was a key strategic ally in the Middle East and in many ways globally in terms of U.S. strategy during the Cold War. And Biden is, like you said, you know, passionately, ideologically invested in Israel. And you now have a situation, and he has, I think, this residual this residual attachment to what analysts used to call the beautiful Israel, you know, some kind of liberal democracy and so on. And I think at one level he realizes that his Israeli allies, those who he's steadfastly supporting, are Netanyahu and the Israeli fascist right, people like Minister of National Security Itamar Ben-Gvir and Minister of Finance Bezalel Smotrich, ultimately has no problems with that. And we keep hearing about growing U.S. criticism and opposition to Israel, to which I always say Netanyahu and his fascist allies must be telling themselves, well, with enemies like this, who needs friends? But, you know, there's also been reporting in the past week about a potential Israeli ground operation in Rafah, in the southern Gaza Strip on the Israeli border, that Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who is no less of a passionate Zionist than Biden, but has been to the region a number of times and is seeing with his own eyes what Israel's genocide and the U.S. support for it is doing to the U.S. Position and U.S. influence in the region, has apparently come out against any Israeli operation, ground operation, and Rafah, of course, ground operation, because it's constantly bombing it from the air as we speak. But Biden is not yet ready to go there. And this also speaks to something else. You know, many people like to think of Zionism that is somehow a Jewish movement or exclusive to Jews. Well, if this reporting is correct, you have Secretary of State Blinken, who is, of course, Jewish, taking a much firmer line, apparently, or taking a firmer line, at least, with Israel than his president, Biden, who is not Jewish. So I think also we need to get, you know, beyond this idea of identifying Israel with Judaism or the Jews, and thinking of it in broader terms, that it's an ideological phenomenon that many different people, including many Jews and many non-Jews, in the West at least, support for a variety of ideological or political reasons, and that many people, including many Jews and many non-Jews, oppose for either ideological or political or moral or policy reasons.
I think that's such an important point, and two pieces of evidence to back up what you're saying there. First of all, a majority of American Jews want to see a ceasefire. So that's number one. So they are, you know, at odds with our Zionist president and the direction of his policy. Second of all, I know I keep bringing up this Pew Research poll, but they had an extraordinary amount of data here that I found really fascinating. They asked different religious groups in America how they felt about the current Netanyahu government and, you know, do you approve, disapprove? And the highest approval ratings were not from Jewish Americans. They were from white evangelical Christians, was actually the group that had the greatest affinity for the, you know, Israeli government as it currently exists with the, as you, I think, accurately put it, right-wing fascist government of Netanyahu.
Yeah, and that's also an interest. It raises a broader point, or two broader points. The first is that I think many would agree, that Israel's most important strategic asset, certainly since the 1960s, has been, above and beyond anything and everything else, the solid bipartisan U.S. support that has enjoyed in Congress, from Democratic administrations, from Republican administrations, and actually, historically, it was the Democratic Party that was the mainstay of U.S. support for Israel. The Republicans were often identified, for example, with the oil industry, with corporate interests that took a more cautious attitude towards the Middle East because they were concerned that excessive U.S. support for Israel might damage U.S. economic interests in the Arab world, whereas the Democrats went all in. Now, what's happened in previous decades is that given the growing shift to the radical right of Israeli politics and to a significant extent of Israeli society as well, that has become much more difficult to sustain. And what we've seen is the Israelis themselves taken the initiative, most prominently under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, to make Israel a partisan issue in U.S. politics, to increasingly explicitly align Israel with the Republican Party, with the right wing of the Republican Party, and specifically with white evangelical Christians, and increasingly less so with mainstream American Jewish public opinion, which tends towards the more liberal end of the spectrum. So it's a doubly self-inflicted wound, because on one hand, the growing radicalism of Israeli politics and society has made the solid bipartisan support that Israel used to enjoy in the United States an increasingly untenable proposition. But above and beyond that, the Israeli leadership itself seems to have gone out of its way to make Israel a partisan political issue in the U.S., which may well have short-term advantages, but over the long term, I think, is going to be a strategic catastrophe for Israel. The other issue, as you mentioned, and our friend Norman Finkelstein has written an entire book on this called Knowing Too Much, regards the American Jewish community, which traditionally has been overwhelmingly liberal and overwhelmingly supportive of Israel. Its problem is that it has become increasingly difficult to both continue embracing core liberal values on the one hand, and to continue embracing Israel on the other. And what we've seen is that growing numbers of American Jews coming to the conclusion that their liberal values are more precious than their support for what they are now recognizing as an apartheid regime, and one that is increasingly becoming a genocidal one as well.
How closely have you tracked Donald Trump's recent comments on the conflict?
I've seen them. I think, as with anything that Trump says, one takes them seriously at your own peril. Mm-hmm. He's perfectly capable of saying one thing in the morning, its exact opposite in the afternoon, and then offering yet a third opinion on precisely the same topic after dinner. The only reason I would find his comments interesting if I recall correctly, he said that Israel risks losing support and should call a ceasefire. Again, as I said,
well, he didn't exactly say ceasefire, but he said they should finish the job and wrap it up. Those were basically his words.
But I think he then made additional comments about Israel losing public support in the U.S. or globally. The only reason I would find those interesting is that apparently, regardless of what he actually thinks, that Trump apparently finds it in his political interest and his electoral interest to make statements like that, which is absolutely not something that would have been expected of him 5 or 10 years ago. And it's a phenomenon I think we're seeing more and more in Western politics where establishment politicians who traditionally have seen loyalty to Israel and blind support for its policies as a political and electoral asset are now increasingly, gradually to be sure, but increasingly taking positions which suggest that they find Israel to be a potential political and electoral burden, and that distancing themselves from Israel may well prove to be a political and electoral asset. It's a slow, gradual, but I think highly significant process to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I mean, I think Trump, unlike Biden, has actually very few ideological commitments. He's very transactional. I think certainly on the issue of Israel, he's pretty purely transactional. You know, if you're in the Republican Party, especially today, given the political shifts you're talking about, that transactional math always adds up to ironclad, do whatever Israel wants. And there's a variety of reasons for that, both, as I was saying, you know, the white evangelical Christian base is very much pro-Zionist, very much in favor of even this current iteration of the Israeli government. You know, Trump received significant campaign contributions last time around from Sheldon Adelson, who is very committed to the cause. So those that transactional math typically adds up, not typically, like uniformly adds up to ironclad support of Israel. But I'll just read you a little bit of that quote that you're referring to so people get the full sensibility and you can react to it if you have any additional comments. But he was asked about Chuck Schumer's recent comments calling for a new government after the war is over, which, you know, provoked a lot of outrage in Israel. And so he was asked about it and he said, I think it's a terrible thing to do because it takes all of your momentum away. But then he goes on to say, you don't have the support you used to have. Some 15 years ago, Israel had the strongest lobby. If you were a politician, you couldn't say anything bad about Israel. That would be like the end of your political career. Today, it's almost the opposite. He then goes on to sort of like rant and rave about AOC and Rashida Tlaib. And then he goes on to say, and 15 years ago, that would have been unthinkable to be doing that. So Israel has to get better with the promotional and with the public relations, because right now they're in ruin. They're being hurt very badly, I think, in a public relations sense, just like classic Trump, that, you know, it's not a problem that they're slaughtering civilians, except that it's creating a bit of a PR headache for them, right?
And no one understands self-promotion like Donald Trump. So if he's saying these things to the government that prior to the Biden administration, he had done more to support than any U.S. President before him. Well, you know, it's worth taking note of that. You know, there's a tradition now dating back, I think, to the late 60s or early 70s, if not earlier, that every time a U.S. administration leaves office, they're always described as the best friend Israel has ever had in the White House. And it's always been true that every successive U.S. administration has done even more for Israel than its predecessor. But given the issues we've been discussing, you know, Biden's extraordinary passionate attachment to Israel and these broader changes that we've been discussing, it may well be that Biden's successor may be the first U.S. president about whom we cannot say he's been the best friend Israel has ever had in the White House. If I could just make one brief comment about white evangelicals, I think what you say about them is generally correct. Although I've also seen some research to suggest that there is also a generational shift occurring within that demographics ranks as well, and that younger white U.S. evangelicals, although by no means staunch advocates of Palestinian rights, seem to be much more coy about this kind of brazen celebration of Israeli legality than their parents.
Yeah, I think that is right. I think any demographic group you look at, the younger generation has a different view, at least somewhat, than the older generations do. So give me your reaction. We had this whole situation unfolding in the UN. First, we had the US offered a draft, a ceasefire resolution that, you know, we sort of crafted and suited our interests and our ends, which was really backing up this negotiation process that we are leading effectively on behalf of Israel that's unfolding right now. Russia and China vetoed that. That gets voted down. Over the weekend, all of the non-permanent members get together. They come up with a draft that the US found at least acceptable enough to abstain from the vote. So this ceasefire resolution, which contained a number of caveats, I'll let you explain that if you want to, was allowed to pass through the, you know, the magnanimity of the Americans. And this provoked quite a reaction from the Israelis, whether it was feigned or not. What did you make of the fact that we did abstain on this vote and allowed this resolution to go through after having vetoed three resolutions previously? Do you see it as a significant or noteworthy step forward? How do you view the potential impact?
I think it's significant without having any impact. So let me explain. You know, the French permanent representative to the UN a few days ago, after concluding closed consultations at the Security Council held, came out with a statement saying that In each and every crisis that the Security Council has dealt with, our initial demand is always for an immediate ceasefire and cessation of hostilities. And then we move to the issue of negotiations and trying to resolve the underlying crisis. And Gaza should be no different. But for some reason in Gaza, we seem to be incapable of calling for a ceasefire. As you've noted, since this crisis erupted, the U.S. has consistently vetoed resolutions calling for a ceasefire and has also voted against them in the General Assembly. So what's happened in recent weeks? Well, the U.S. proposed its own resolution, as you mentioned, a few days ago, which was presented as a ceasefire resolution, but in fact wasn't, because it had this kind of word salad that didn't amount to ceasefire, and then made even that dependent on the release of Israeli captives and hostages in the Gaza Strip. And then we have the current resolution that passed yesterday, which is significant in a number of respects. First of all, it was drafted and submitted not by Algeria, which is a current Arab member of the Security Council, nor by U.S. adversaries, Russia or China, but rather collectively by the 10 elected members of the Security Council. And these are not a political bloc. You know, they include close U.S. allies like Japan and South Korea. They also include, you know, Guyana, Mozambique, Ecuador, and all these very different countries somehow managed to come together and collectively submit a draft really representing what the entire world has been calling for now, for a ceasefire. So merely the fact of the authorship of that resolution put the U.S. In a corner and demonstrated how extraordinarily isolated it has become on the global stage with its continuing passionate attachment, as we just were discussing, to Israel and its genocidal assault. Secondly, the resolution calls for a ceasefire during the Muslim month of Ramadan, which began on the 9th or 10th of March and will continue to the 9th or 10th of April. So by managing to drag out the discussions and the negotiations till yesterday, well, half the month is already gone. So it's really a call for a two-week ceasefire. Nevertheless, it's not an urging for a ceasefire, but it demands an immediate ceasefire for the month of Ramadan. The initial draft was leading to a permanent ceasefire, a permanent cessation of hostilities, which after the draft resolution was finalized, apparently with the agreement of the United States, Washington then came back and said that unless permanent ceasefire was replaced with lasting and sustainable ceasefire, it would veto the resolution. Hmm. And apparently the authors agreed. And so, and the other elements of the resolution is it calls for an immediate and unconditional release of all hostages and for all parties to treat their captives in line with international law. And the third element concerning responsibilities regarding humanitarian aid. So as you mentioned, the resolution passed yesterday. The 14 members voted against for the resolution, and the U.S., which even with this very toned, watered down resolution, still couldn't bring itself to cast a vote that would demonstrate that it considers Palestinians actual human beings rather than expendable and irrelevant human scum, could do no more than simply abstain from this resolution. Okay, that happened. Immediately thereafter, the first thing the U.S. Did is it characterized this resolution as non-binding because it was not adopted under Chapter 7 of Security Council procedures. This is completely bogus. The UN Charter makes very clear that each and every single UN Security Council resolution is by definition international law and by definition binding upon not only all Security Council members, but in fact is binding upon all United Nations member states. The US and the UK have in the past sought to suggest that resolutions that are not adopted under Chapter 7 are less binding than others. But there was, in fact, a court case in the International Court of Justice, which is the ultimate arbiter of UN regulations and procedures. There was a court case in, I believe, 1970 or maybe 1971 on this very issue, and which stated explicitly there is no hierarchy in UN Security Council resolutions. They are all binding and they are all equally binding.
And Muin, can you just for 1 second, can you explain what the difference would be from a practical perspective, why it's so important to them to make this distinction between whether it's binding or non-binding?
Well, I think the U.S. was trying to demonstrate, yes, we did vote for this resolution, and yes, it does demand an immediate ceasefire, but it's not binding, so there doesn't need to. So what we voted, what is stated in the resolution doesn't actually need to happen. In other words, it tried to present the case that the resolution made a recommendation for a ceasefire, which Israel would be free to respect or ignore, rather than make clear that that resolution is now a matter of international law, and every member state of the UN, in this case Israel, is under an obligation to immediately implement a ceasefire. So that was the first way that the U.S. tried to water it down. Secondly, the resolution demands, on the one hand, an immediate and unconditional ceasefire, and on the other hand, demands the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages. And it's specifically worded in a way that these two things need to happen, but need to happen independently, rather than one being a function of the other. In other words, it's worded in such a way that Israel cannot say, well, since our captives and hostages aren't released, we're not going to accept the demand for a ceasefire. The U.S. position was, in fact, these things are intertwined and are dependent on each other. And if I could just backtrack for one moment, the authors of the resolution also made a point of using the exact same wording of a Security Council resolution that was passed in, I believe, 2014 or 2015, demanding a ceasefire in Syria, which the U.S. voted for, and which the U.S. subsequently stated it considered binding. So the exact binding when applied to U.S. adversary, but elective when applied to a U.S. ally. So anyway, that's the second issue. The third issue is that on that very same day, the Biden administration issued a determination that Israel is using U.S. weaponry in line with not only international law, but also U.S. domestic law. And as far as the U.S. Legislation that bars the transfer of weapons to states that interfere with the provision of U.S. humanitarian aid goes, it said Israel is also in compliance with that legislation. So in effect, it's the biggest possible middle finger imaginable to the Security Council and to its resolutions. And what the U.S. was seeking to do was to demonstrate that it considered this resolution that it allowed to pass really entirely meaningless. And should any doubt remain, the U.S. White House and State Department spokespeople made clear that nothing will change and nothing needs to change.
So I actually have one of those exchanges from the incomparable Matt Lee, pressing State Department spokesperson Matt Miller on exactly this point. Let's take a listen to how that went down.
So what do you expect now to happen as a result of the passage of this resolution?
So I think
you expect that Israel is going to announce a ceasefire.
I do not.
It's, and that, so do you expect that Hamas is going to release hostages?
So I'm glad you get you mentioned that, because one of the things that we have objected to for some time is that most of the people that call for a ceasefire, we believe, are calling for Israel to unilaterally stop operations and not calling for Hamas to agree to a ceasefire where they would release hostages.
Well, I think it goes both ways, doesn't it?
It could. But so the but the resolution today is a non-binding resolution. But
okay, what's the point? Why did you abstain? Why didn't you veto?
We didn't veto because we thought the language in it was consistent with something that the language as it relates to the ceasefire and release of hostage was consistent with the longstanding United States position.
So you don't believe anything is going to happen as a result of the passage of this resolution?
So I think that separate and apart from this resolution, we have active ongoing negotiations to try to achieve what this resolution calls for, mm-hmm. which is the an immediate ceasefire and the release of hostages. I don't know. I can't say that this resolution is going to have any impact on those negotiations. So, but those negotiations are ongoing. They've been ongoing over the weekend, and they've made progress.
So I don't expect you to answer this now, but to me, you just stick this in your pocket. If that's the case, what the hell is the point of the UN? The UN Security Council.
So we think it plays an important role.
It does, even though its action does absolutely nothing. And that you're going to get what you would like to see, not out of the UN, but out of discussions in Doha.
So we believe it's important that the UN speak and the UN Security Council speak on matters of international security. It's why we've been engaged in this process. It's why we thought we were going to have a successful vote on Friday that Russia and China unfortunately and quite cynically vetoed. But I do believe that ultimately, if we were able to achieve a ceasefire and the release of hostages, is going to come not through a UN process, but through the process with which we've been engaged, yes, in Doha.
So he says, what the hell is even the point of the UN and the UN Security Council? And it's a great question. I mean, it seems like the US is intent on systematically detonating every institution, every even imaginary version, fantasy version that we ever had of international law in service of letting Israel do what Israel wants to do.
You know, it's almost a Monty Python sketch, what we just saw. It's incredible. But, you know, Miller kept referring to these negotiations. Those are interesting in their own right, because, of course, the U.S. has a policy and an explicit agreement with Israel that any U.S. diplomatic initiative will contain no surprises for Israel. What this means in practice is that when the U.S. presents an initiative, that it has already been discussed with the Israelis and has acquired Israeli consent, or at least no Israeli opposition, which is another way of saying these aren't American initiatives. These are Israeli initiatives being presented by the Americans. So to suggest that the U.S. is somehow a mediator here, let alone an honest broker, doesn't hold very much water. And then, you know, of course, you always get this whole circus of the U.S. presenting an initiative, the Israelis graciously accepting it, and then the Palestinians saying, well, it doesn't meet their minimal demands. And then the U.S. government and all its allies and its media piling on and saying, oh, the rejectionist Arabs and all the rest of it. So it's really, it's a pure performance. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, you referenced the fact that the State Department just certified this letter saying, oh, no, Israel, they're abiding by international law. They're not blocking humanitarian aid. And I expected it, but I still find it so outrageous and so galling. You literally had Tony Blinken last week saying 100% of the population of Gaza is experiencing severe levels of acute food insecurity. We cannot, we must not allow that to continue. He goes on to say, we've never seen this before, where an entire people is suffering from this level of acute food insecurity. And less than a week later, it's, oh, yeah, no problem with the humanitarian aid. They're not blocking humanitarian aid. We're, as the State Department, we're certifying it's all good here. It's, I mean, it's just, I have no words for it anymore. You know, I really have no words for how monstrous it is.
You're right that it is outrageous. But I would make a few short observations. The first is the mere fact that this UN Security Council resolution passed. And the reason I think it's significant, despite having no impact on the ground, is that it demonstrates in a very visible fashion how isolated the United States and its protege Israel are on the stage regarding this determination that Israel is acting in compliance with international law and U.S. Domestic legislation. Well, I think it makes the Biden administration the laughingstock of the entire world that it would come out and say this with a straight face for the reasons you mentioned. Thirdly, I think maybe we also should consider the possibility that this is the Biden administration's way of confirming once again that it considers the Palestinian people irrelevant and expendable human scum, and that Israel is using U.S. weaponry precisely the way the United States would like to see Israel use these weapons against the Palestinian people.
Yeah, I think there's no other conclusion that you could really come to at this point. I know you had a chance to look over a bit of the draft report titled Anatomy of a Genocide that was prepared by the Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories. First of all, you know, any reflections on that report and the contents of it? And also, if you believe that may have an impact or be influential with the International Court of Justice in particular?
Well, I haven't, unfortunately, had the opportunity to read it in detail. I was able to skim through it and see its main conclusions. And I would just respond to directly to your question. I think the significant issue here is that the International Court of Justice, unlike the International Criminal Court, is a UN organ. It's one of the principal UN organs, and therefore, you could almost consider it a kind of obligation, even if that's putting it too strongly. The ICJ will take UN documents particularly seriously. And I think this is part of the reason that it ultimately responded positively to South Africa's application in December, was because so much of the information contained in the South African application was based on UN sources. Right. So the ICJ basically had to either confirm the validity of what the UN was saying or go against its own organization, so to speak. I think this report is a little different because of the way it was produced. But nevertheless, it will now become an official UN document. It will have to be carefully studied by the ICJ. And again, I have to read it in detail, but from what I've seen, it seems to be a well-argued summary of the case against Israel, which once again finds that there is a plausible case against Israel for genocide. The other conclusion that's reached in this report is it calls on the international community to impose an arms embargo on Israel. So this, again, ratchets up the pressure on those who think that delivering weapons to Israel is a purely commercial matter without any political or genocidal implications, and increases the pressure on them. And it's kind of, I think we also need to look at it as a cumulative process. First, you had the South Africans, then others, now the UN Special Rapporteur. And it's increasingly, I think, stigmatizing Israel as not only an apartheid regime, but also as a genocidal state.
So I'll just read the conclusion for everyone that was arrived at in this report. They say the context, facts, and analysis presented in this report lead to the conclusion that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating Israel's commission of genocide is met more broadly. They also indicate that Israel's actions have been driven by a genocidal logic integral to its settler colonial project in Palestine, signaling a tragedy foretold. And I found that part interesting as well, that they're tying it not just to this current moment, but to the sort of essence of the settler colonial project itself. You know, Maween, you've said, I've said, many of others have said, even Donald Trump is sort of warning Israel, you're becoming isolated, you know, in Trump's words, you got this big PR problem, you're becoming ostracized, all of these ratcheting up pressures. What does it amount to? And when does it amount to something tangible that we can really see? What does this look like going forward?
Well, I should point out, we've been here before. In the mid-1970s, Israel, along with South Africa, were both pariah states. It's true, only South Africa was expelled from the UN General Assembly, but that same General Assembly passed a resolution determining that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination. Of course, the U.S. Went crazy and spent the subsequent 15 years trying to reverse that resolution. And then in 1990-91, in the aftermath of the Kuwait crisis, and basically as, you know, this was the unipolar moment, if you will, the Soviet Union had just disintegrated. And as part of the price for its hosting of the 1991 Madrid Peace Conference, the UN General Assembly, with Arab support, was required to renounce its resolution, which described Zionism as what it was. I think now the pendulum is turning back. Increasingly now, I think governments are realizing they made a mistake, not when they passed a resolution declaring Zionism to be a form of racism and racial discrimination, but they made a mistake when they renounced that resolution in 1991. Can't remember exactly when it was, and we're gradually heading towards that situation. Again, there have been reports that South Africa may be preparing a motion to have Israel expelled from the UN General Assembly, its membership suspended, similar to what happened to the white minority regime of South Africa during the 1970s. And as you say, when Israel's closest allies, Trump, Blinken, some in Europe and others, are warning Israel that it's heading towards pariah status. And when Israel has become such an irrational state that it treats its closest friends as sworn enemies, then, you know, things are not going to end well for it.
Maween, tell people where they can find you and follow your work.
Most of my work is published on the website of Jadalia, where I'm a co-editor, and that's www.jadalia.com.
Well, I have so appreciated getting to speak with you today, and more broadly, you know, I've really relied on your analysis. By the way, Kyle was very sorry that he couldn't join for this interview because he is a big admirer of you and your work as well. So thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.